This is The Growth Journey. Real life, real growth, divinely inspired. Where military discipline meets a ministry heart. With 40 years of life-shaping experience, including 22 years on active duty, and a deep calling to ministry, David Averett, CEO and founder of CA Jail Outreach Nationwide, shares spirit-led wisdom and practical tools to transform your life. He's also the author of an ebook on growth, bringing even more insight to help you flourish in faith, marriage, leadership, character, church, and business. Ready for divinely inspired results? Let's get started.
Let's get started.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. We're here to really dig into fascinating topics and pull out the things that matter. And today, wow, we're tackling something huge, a question that's really changing spiritual life for, well, millions. Why are so many people finding their spiritual nourishment from a screen rather than sitting in a pew? It's this profound shift, you know, how people are seeking that spiritual connection in our super digital world. It touches everyone, really.
It really is a seismic change. I mean, think about it. You've got these digital influencers, right? They're pulling in audiences of thousands, sometimes, you know, tens of thousands watching live at the same time. Meanwhile, many traditional faith-based communities, they might gather a few hundred, maybe 1,000 on a good Sunday.
That's a massive difference.
Huge. And it's not just about eyeballs on screens. It hits the finances, too.
Mm.
Nearly half, 50% of all faith-based giving. It's happening online now.
Wow.
Yeah. And get this. Over a third of people who find a new faith community, they discover it digitally first, online.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what we're diving into today. Our exploration is grounded in a really compelling memoir. It's titled Click and Connect, Building Bridges of Community Between Hybrid and Traditional Church Organizations and Faith-Based Organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, throughout this deep dive, when we talk about faith-based communities or ministries, just know we're using that as shorthand. We mean churches, sure, but also other religious organizations, various faith-based groups. It's all-encompassing, just like Mr. Averett explains in his memoir.
That's a good clarification.
Right. So our mission today is to pull out the key insights, maybe some surprising truths, from this really powerful memoir. We're focusing on the future, you know, the future of faith-based engagement. We really want to help you, our listener, make sense of this huge change and maybe see why the future of spiritual connection, well, it might look radically different than you ever thought possible.
And the author behind this insightful memoir, that's David Averett. David is the CEO and founder of CA Jail Outreach. He also serves as a chaplain with that organization. And he's retired military personnel as well. Now, it's really important to note, he was a leader in the military, yes, but not a military chaplain. That's key. His chaplaincy now, his current work, is within the jail system.
Got it. Military leader, current jail chaplain.
Exactly. And he brings this incredible foundation. We're talking 40 years of Bible knowledge. It comes from, well, everywhere. College studies, military training, loads of online study, a whole lifetime really spent studying the Word. And maybe most importantly, that deep personal time spent with God through prayer and meditation.
That's quite a background. And it makes his perspective really valuable, doesn't it? It ties straight into this this really poignant opening quote from the memoir. Chaplain David says this, he reflects. I need spiritual nourishment daily. If it's not readily available for my traditional church in digital forms, I'll find it elsewhere because my faith journey doesn't pause for dial-up.
Wow. That just perfectly captures the urgency, that personal need that's driving this whole digital shift in faith, right? It's like this hunger that just won't wait for the old ways.
Mm-hmm.
It absolutely does. It hits the nail on the head. And just a quick note for you, our listener, before we jump right in. To really make the most of our time together in this deep dive, we're going to focus on delivering these key insights from the memoir. We'll be setting aside, for now, the really in-depth scriptural references and all the detailed supporting material.
Sorry.
But don't worry, for a complete exploration of everything we discussed today, including all those supporting scriptures and more details, you can find the full version on the CA Jail Outreach website. There's a link for you right in the deep dive description. Makes it easy.
That's great. Good to know the full depth is available. And, you know, while you're thinking about CA Jail Outreach, just remember their dedication. They're all about providing hope and, crucially, second chances to inmates and their families, often during incredibly tough times. So as you listen today, maybe keep the children in these families in your thoughts and prayers. The justice system, well, it impacts loved ones in those households, kids who haven't done anything wrong themselves.
A really important point. Thank you for adding that.
Okay, let's dive in. Section 1. I, the prophecy unsealed. Daniel 12.4 and the dawn of digital knowledge. All right, let's unpack this first big idea. The memoir kicks off with something really thought-provoking. It connects our current digital age to ancient scripture, specifically Daniel chapter 12, verse 4. It says, "But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." It's remarkable how much that sounds like right now, isn't it?
It is striking, truly. Mr. Averett in the memoir really synthesizes this. He looks at many shall run to and fro and interprets it not just as, you know, physical travel, people moving around.
Right, like getting on planes or cars.
Exactly. But also as the rapid movement across the internet. Think about how fast we jump. Website to website, app to app, link to link. It's this constant digital motion connecting us instantly across the globe. Kind of digital running to and fro.
That makes perfect sense.
And then the second part, knowledge shall be increased.
Yeah.
Well, that's just undeniable, isn't it? We're living through this staggering explosion of information. It's everywhere.
Oh, absolutely. You see it every single day. It's almost overwhelming sometimes.
It is. We're talking YouTube tutorials on anything, endless social media feeds, podcasts on every niche imaginable, audiobooks, ebooks. You can ask Google or Alexa for advice on, well, practically anything, right? And get some kind of informal answer in seconds.
True. Need to fix a leaky faucet. Ask Google.
Exactly. And this includes a massive amount of Bible-related material, too. Mm-hmm. Countless Bible apps, commentaries online. It really cuts down on the need to physically, you know, pore over heavy reference books like people used to. Mm-hmm. You can search the internet and find the specific verse or topic you need in just seconds.
But here's what's fascinating, something David Averett points out in the memoir. All this access, this increased knowledge, it hasn't necessarily made us smarter in like a deep wisdom kind of way. It just makes us feel more knowledgeable. There's a difference.
That's a crucial distinction he makes. Absolutely critical. The memoir really digs into this. It talks about the benefits, of course, faster learning, access to way more information than any generation before us. You can get a quick grasp of almost any topic imaginable.
Yeah, a surface level understanding maybe?
Precisely.
Yeah.
But then it highlights the drawbacks. The constant distraction, our attention spans are shot.
Tell me about it.
The incredibly rapid spread of misinformation, which is a huge problem.
Right.
And this potential for overconfidence. We feel like we know a lot because we can look anything up instantly, but it might just be surface level.
So what does this all mean for us, you know, as people seeking truth in this digital flood?
Well, the memoir really serves as this potent reminder, doesn't it? To actively seek true wisdom, real discernment, amidst this deluge of information. It stresses ensuring we stay deeply rooted in God's truth, prioritizing our actual relationship with Him above just accumulating facts.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about what we know, but how we know it, and importantly, what we do with that knowledge. It's about wisdom, not just data. 2, the digital shift in sacred spaces. New pressures, new paradigms.
That's actually a perfect bridge to the next big point, the core impact of this whole digital revolution, how it's profoundly reshaping the entire landscape for faith-based communities, for ministries. This shift, it creates these really unique pressures, but also some unparalleled opportunities for the leaders within these groups.
Precisely. And the memoir discusses this emerging hybrid model of worship. It's becoming much more common and a key driver. Often it's sheer convenience. That's what pulls people towards online options.
Makes sense.
Yeah. But while these online platforms undeniably offer incredible reach, you know, expanded accessibility, the memoir is clear. They usually fall short when it comes to replicating those deep social connections. And also the tangible health benefits that studies show are linked with actually being there, in-person attendance.
Right. There's something about being physically present.
There really is. So it's often a trade-off, or at least leaders have to figure out how to balance the two effectively.
So let's talk about those unique pressures. What are some of the specific challenges leaders in these faith-based communities are facing now? Mr. Averett highlights several in the memoir.
He does. And, you know, ministries face some challenges that are similar to secular businesses, like keeping up with tech, managing data. But these pressures are often amplified because of the, well, the sacred trust involved in faith communities.
That makes sense. Higher stakes, maybe.
Exactly. So first off, cybersecurity risks. This is huge. These organizations collect really sensitive data, personal details, financial information for donations.
Right. Tithing records, membership lists.
All of it. This makes them prime targets for cyber criminals. And if their protection isn't up to scratch, it can lead to serious legal trouble, massive liabilities, and maybe even worse, a complete erosion of trust within their community.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard to rebuild.
Definitely. What else?
Second big one, misinformation. The internet is incredible for spreading information quickly, right? But that includes religious content, too. And while sometimes that's good, getting the message out, it also means misinterpretations of scripture or even outright false teachings can spread like wildfire. This can seriously compromise doctrinal integrity.
So staying true to the core message becomes harder.
It does. And the memoir actually connects this directly to scripture. It references Colossians chapter 2, verse 8, which warns believers to beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit, after the tradition of men, after the rudiments of the world, and not after Christ.
Wow, that's a powerful warning. Seems very relevant.
It feels incredibly relevant today, doesn't it? It's a timeless call for discernment. And the third major pressure point, pastoral fatigue, burnout.
Ah, yes, I hear about this a lot.
It's a real crisis. Leaders are trying to balance all their traditional duties, preparing sermons, visiting the sick, counseling, you know, the core pastoral work. But now, on top of all that, they're expected to manage online communities, create engaging digital content, maybe stream services, adapt sermons for both audiences.
It's like having two full-time jobs.
It often feels that way. And it's leading to significant burnout among pastors and their staff. It's a heavy load.
David, in the memoir, then draws this really interesting comparison. He talks about two different types of leaders. Can you unpack that for us?
Yes, it's a helpful distinction Mr. Averett makes. He contrasts, relational leaders think of them often as shepherds with organizational leaders.
Okay, relational versus organizational.
Right. So the relational leaders, the shepherds, they thrive on personal contact, direct interaction. Their real strength is building those deep one-on-one connections. They know everyone's name, their story.
The classic pastor image for many people.
Exactly. But the potential downside, they can really struggle to scale their ministry beyond a certain size without completely burning out. Their model is so hands-on, so personal. Now, contrast that with the organizational leaders. These leaders are driven more by systems that care for people.
Systems. How does that work?
Their focus is on improving processes, developing other leaders within the organization, creating structures that can scale, ensuring the ministry runs effectively even as it grows. Now, the memoir emphasizes something important here. Both types of leaders need strong organizational and interpersonal skills in today's world.
Okay, so it's not either skill-wise.
Not entirely.
Yeah.
And both definitely need a grasp of technology now. But there's this unique tension Mr. Averett highlights. He notes that congregants often really love their local faith-based community, their local pastor.
Yeah, that personal connection.
Right. But they might dislike or feel disconnected from the broader denomination or the larger organizational structure and the digital age. It just amplifies this tension because a relational leader focused on those deep personal ties can easily get overwhelmed trying to manage a large, dispersed online community alongside their in-person flock.
I can see that, spreading themselves too thin.
Precisely. So the memoir concludes that for a hybrid ministry to really be effective and sustainable long term, it might very well need a strong organizational leader steering the ship, or at least a very clear division of labor between relational and organizational roles. Someone has to manage the systems for it to work at scale. 3, the global digital pulpit, convenience, competition, and reach.
Now, here's another powerful thought from Chaplain David in the memoir. He says, the digital marketplace of faith offers endless choices. Our calling is to offer timeless truth amidst the noise. And that really captures the challenge, doesn't it? Standing out in this vast ocean of online voices.
It absolutely does. It's a perfect summary. The memoir explains how suddenly sermons, Bible studies, even fellowship, it's all globally accessible through social media, YouTube channels, podcasts, you name it.
Instantly available.
Instantly. And this constant, easy access creates what the memoir calls a consumeristic culture of worship. That's a key phrase.
Consumeristic culture. What does that mean exactly?
It means people now essentially shop for faith-based content.
Mm.
They're not limited by geography anymore. They choose based on convenience, maybe the speaker style, the production quality, much like they choose other consumer products or media.
So ministries are competing for attention.
Definitely. They're operating in what economists call an attention economy. They're competing not just with the ministry down the street, but with a vast global array of religious content creators. And the competition is fierce. It's constant.
That puts a lot of pressure on.
It does. And the memoir connects this to scripture again, referencing Luke chapter 8, verse 18. It advises, Take heed therefore how ye hear, for whosoever hath, to him shall be given, and whosoever hath not, from him shall be taken even that which he seemeth to have. Which really underscores the importance of being discerning about what we choose to listen to, what we consume spiritually in this noisy marketplace.
So, digging deeper, why exactly are people making this choice, choosing online worship over showing up in person? The memoir breaks down several key motivations.
Yes, it outlines five main reasons based on what people are saying and trends observed. First, and maybe the biggest, is convenience. Online worship just eliminates so many barriers. No commuting through traffic, no need for specific dress codes, no stress about finding parking.
All those little Sunday morning hurdles.
Exactly. It offers this unparalleled flexibility that just fits more easily into people's busy modern lives. Second is accessibility. This is absolutely vital. Think about people with physical limitations or chronic health concerns, or maybe those who are traveling. Online options ensure they're not cut off from spiritual nourishment.
That's a huge benefit for many.
Huge. Third is privacy. Online platforms allow people to explore faith, maybe dip their toes in, without public scrutiny. This can be really appealing for someone who's new to faith, or perhaps had a negative past experience, or just prefers a less public form of engagement.
Less pressure, maybe.
Right. Fourth is the sense of global community. Digital platforms can connect really diverse groups of people from all over the world. You can find fellowship and connection that actually transcends geographical boundaries, which is pretty amazing.
It is.
And fifth, the memoir talks about digital justice. This is important. Creating robust, easy-to-use online options helps bridge the digital divide. It ensures that people who might have limited physical access or maybe aren't as digitally literate aren't left behind in this shift. It's about inclusion.
Chaplain David puts this so well, doesn't he? He says, "My spirit seeks truth, and today that often means swiping, clicking, or listening to find it. The message moves, so I move with it."
It's such a clear articulation of that personal drive meeting the digital reality.
And this drive ties into what the memoir calls the information explosion in faith, right?
Precisely. It traces this rapid expansion of digital religious engagement, really taking off around 1999 with early online ministries or ritual websites. But today, it's exponential. People are using websites, apps, social media, even artificial intelligence now for religious study and connection.
AI for faith. That's fascinating.
It is. And think about YouVersion's Bible app. The memoir cites it has over 875 million installations worldwide. That's staggering reach.
Incredible numbers.
And Mr. Averitt points out something really telling. Consistently, among the top search terms on these faith platforms are words like prayer and peace. And what does that tell you? It indicates this profound, global, human need for solace, for guidance, for spiritual connection in our often chaotic world.
But with all this easy access, this democratization of information, doesn't that also create a challenge to traditional authority structures within faith communities?
Oh, absolutely. That's a major theme in the memoir. It addresses how these popular online influencers, people with huge followings, they can gain what's called de facto authority. They might not be ordained. They might not have formal theological training in the traditional sense.
But people listen to them. They have influence.
Massive influence.
Yeah.
Simply because of their reach, their charisma, their perceived expertise. And this can potentially lead to theological fragmentation, lots of different interpretations floating around, and again, the rapid spread of misinformation or even heresy.
So there's a real need for guidance.
A critical need. The memoir highlights why it's so important for established, trained leaders to actively engage in this digital space, to provide that authoritative guidance, that sound direction, to help people navigate this complex landscape. And again, Scripture speaks to this. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 1, offers a stark warning. Quote, "But there were false prophets also among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you, who privily shall bring in damnable heresies, even denying the Lord that bought them, and bring upon themselves swift destruction."
Another timeless warning.
It really is. It reminds us that discernment is absolutely key in this new digital frontier. And just to put some numbers on this shift, the memoir shares some fascinating data on U.S. religious service participation between 2022 and 2025. Only about 17% attend in person monthly, and 25% make it weekly.
That seems low.
It reflects the changing patterns. Compare that to online. 8% watch online or on TV only monthly, 16% do it weekly, and then you have this hybrid group. 16% participate both ways each month. So if you add it all up, the total monthly participation, any mode, in person, online, or both, comes out to around 40%.
So nearly half are engaging somehow each month, but a huge chunk of that involves digital.
Exactly. It clearly illustrates just how significant digital engagement has become in the landscape of American faith. 4. What is a hybrid church, organizations, and faith-based organizations?
Okay, so let's nail down this definition. What exactly is a hybrid faith-based community or organization?
Right, good question. The memoir defines it as a community that intentionally combines in-person gatherings with online experiences. So they're offering worship, teaching, fellowship, community engagement, all of it in both physical and digital formats.
So it's not just sticking a camera in the back of the room?
Not if it's done well, no. It contrasts sharply with a purely traditional ministry, which really centers almost all its activities around in-person services within a physical building. The key difference, as the memoir really emphasizes, is this idea of a blended strategy. It's about intentionally integrating the online and the offline experiences, making them work together.
Okay, a blended intentional strategy. Makes sense.
And this blended approach, well, it demands a whole new level of understanding and skill from leaders. The memoir goes into detail about why these hybrid ministries are often tracking their audience using various digital tools and platforms.
Ah, the data aspect. Why are they doing that?
Several key reasons. Primarily, it's to gain insights for ministry effectiveness. Technology lets them gather data on who's engaging, how often, with what content, patterns, and giving. All this helps them make much more informed decisions to better serve their congregations, both online and in person.
So they know what's actually working.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The data reveals what content resonates, who they're reaching, and where they might need to adjust their outreach or discipleship efforts. Second reason, to measure reach and impact. Tracking allows these ministries to actually see their expanded footprint beyond their physical walls. For instance, the memoir mentions that the average number of online service views increased by a significant 32% in 2024 alone. That shows real growth potential in digitally engaged ministries.
Wow, 32%.
Yeah. Third, to improve financial stability. By tracking digital giving patterns, they can better monitor donation trends, encourage consistent giving, especially with recurring online donations becoming so popular and easy to set up. Fourth is about personalizing experiences. Data can help automate routine administrative tasks, manage member databases more effectively, and even personalize online interactions or content recommendations.
Making it feel more relevant to the individual.
Potentially, yes. And fifth, it helps them understand faith-based community shopping trends. Remember that attention economy we talked about? Ministries are competing with global content. Tracking helps them understand how people are making choices, what factors influence their decision to engage with one ministry's content over another, often based on convenience or specific content preferences.
Mr. Averett mentions in the memoir that independent hybrid ministries are growing fast. He cites a number around 44,000 in the U.S. alone. That's a lot.
It is a significant number, really highlights the trend.
But it raises this really big, maybe even uncomfortable question. Do these hybrid models actually meet Bible standards?
Ah, yes. That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And it's complex. The memoir tackles it with a lot of nuance, acknowledging upfront that there are varying interpretations among faithful leaders and congregants. It's not black and white for everyone.
Okay, so what are the arguments for them meeting biblical standards, or at least being biblically permissible?
Well, the memoir outlines a few key arguments. First, the idea of expanded reach for the gospel. Hybrid models clearly extend a ministry's reach far beyond its physical location. They can connect with people who might never walk into a traditional church, building the isolated, the searching, those in other countries. This aligns pretty clearly with the biblical mandate to spread the gospel globally, the Great Commission.
Reaching more people, that seems like a positive.
Generally seen as one, yes. Second is accessibility and inclusion. We touched on this. Online options make ministry accessible to people with physical limitations, health issues, travel constraints. This reflects a compassionate, inclusive approach often highlighted in Scripture. Third is the potential for digital discipleship. Hybrid models open up new avenues for spiritual growth, online Bible studies, virtual small groups, mentoring across distances. And related to that, fourth is this concept of micro-discipleship.
Micro-discipleship? What's that?
It's the idea that people are increasingly consuming spiritual nourishment in shorter, more frequent, often personalized formats. Think podcast during a commute, a quick Bible app devotional, a short teaching video. Hybrid models excel at providing this kind of ongoing, bite-sized spiritual formation.
Okay, those all sound like pretty clear benefits aligning with the spirit of ministry. But what about the other side? What are the challenges or the points of tension regarding biblical standards?
This is where it gets really debated. The memoir highlights several significant challenges. The primary tension point, honestly, is the potential dilution of embodied community. The Bible, particularly the New Testament, consistently portrays the church not just as a concept, but as a local, gathered assembly of believers, people physically together.
Right, the emphasis on assembling yourselves together.
Exactly. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 25 is a classic text here. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as ye see the day approaching. And studies back this up. The memoir cites research showing that while online platforms offer convenience, they often fall significantly short in replicating those deep social bonds, that sense of tangible community. And crucially, they don't seem to provide the same health and social benefits associated with in-person attendance.
We talked about those health benefits earlier. They're quite significant.
They really are. In-person religious attendance consistently correlates with improved mental and physical health outcomes. Virtual attendance. The studies cited show it does not, and can even be linked sometimes to increased depressive symptoms or loneliness. Mm. That social capital, the networks, the support, the shared experience you get from physically gathering it, might not be fully replicable online.
That's a major point of concern. What else?
There's also the issue of passive engagement. We touch on this too. Data suggests a large majority of online worshipers admit to multitasking during services.
Checking email, folding laundry.
Exactly. And many don't feel like active participants. They're watching, consuming, but maybe not fully engaging in worship in the same way someone physically present might. This raises questions about the depth of the spiritual engagement happening. And finally, there's the challenge to pastoral care depth. The traditional shepherding role of a pastor often involves deeply personal, hands-on care.
Like visiting people in the hospital, counseling face-to-face.
Right. Hospital visits, sitting with the grieving, mediating conflicts, really personal discipleship moments. These things are inherently much more challenging, sometimes frankly impossible, to do effectively in a purely online context.
So if we try to connect all these dots, looking at the big picture, it sounds like the memoir is suggesting that online ministry, while valuable, should primarily serve as kind of a bridge to in-person engagement. Is that a fair summary?
That is precisely the conclusion the memoir draws, and it's presented as a really crucial point. While hybrid models offer these undeniable advantages in terms of reach and accessibility, the core debate about whether they fully meet traditional biblical standards often comes back to the irreplaceable value of that embodied physical community and the unique depth of in-person pastoral care. So yes, many leaders and the memoir itself lean towards the idea that online ministry should ideally function as that bridge to in-person engagement. The goal should be to draw people in, using digital tools to connect, but ultimately encouraging them to join and participate in a local physical community, rather than seeing online as a full-blown replacement for it. It's about bringing people closer, not just keeping them comfortably at a distance. The impact of hybrid models on traditional church organizations and faith-based organizations.
Okay, let's dig into this dynamic now. For those traditional faith-based communities, the ones rooted in physical presence, what happens when they start embracing these hybrid models? It seems like a complex decision, creating both incredible opportunities and some pretty significant challenges. It's definitely not a simple choice to make, is it?
No, not at all. It's a profound integration, really. Adopting a hybrid model fundamentally reshapes almost everything a traditional ministry does. The memoir details several clear pros for traditional ministries embracing hybrid models. Let's start with the positives. First, and most obviously, expanded reach and new growth. Hybrid models allow these established organizations to extend their ministry far beyond their geographical limits. They could reach people who, for whatever reason, wouldn't or couldn't attend their in-person services. This can lead to new members, a broader congregational base, potentially new life for a plateaued ministry.
Opening doors that were previously closed.
Exactly. Second, increased accessibility. We've covered this, but it's crucial for traditional groups too. Making ministry available online serves those with physical limitations, health issues, travel conflicts, shift workers. It brings people into the fold who might otherwise be excluded. Third, enhanced engagement opportunities. Digital platforms aren't just for streaming sermons. They offer new avenues for discipleship, online Bible studies, virtual small groups, prayer chains, discussion forums, which can complement and deepen the existing in-person programs.
Adding layers to the community life.
Precisely. Fourth, improve financial stability. This is a big one. By adopting digital giving options, and remember, nearly half of giving transactions are now digital, ministries can often stabilize and even increase their donations. It helps offset potential declines from lower in-person attendance and makes giving easier and more consistent for members.
That makes sense from a practical standpoint.
It does. Fifth, data-driven ministry. We talked about tracking. Technology enables even traditional ministries adopting hybrid models to gather data on engagement, attendance, giving patterns. This allows for more informed decisions, helping them allocate resources effectively and better serve the actual needs of their congregation. And finally, number six, modernization and relevance. Let's face it, embracing hybrid models helps traditional organizations stay relevant in a rapidly changing digital world. It can make them more appealing to younger generations and, frankly, to anyone accustomed to digital interactions in every other area of their life.
Okay, that sounds like a pretty compelling case for going hybrid, almost like a win-win. But I know the memoir also raises some significant downsides, some real challenges. What are the cons for traditional ministries embracing hybrid models?
Yes, there are definitely critical drawbacks and potential pitfalls leaders need to consider very carefully. The primary concern, echoing our earlier discussion, is the potential dilution of embodied community. There's a real risk that as online participation increases, it could inadvertently weaken those profound social connections, that tangible sense of community that's so central to traditional faith life.
Losing something vital in the shift.
Potentially, yes. And as the memoir notes, the research consistently links in-person religious attendance with those positive mental and physical health outcomes. Virtual attendance, not so much. Online platforms often struggle to replicate those specific benefits. Secondly, there's the very real issue of increased workload and pastoral fatigue. We can't stress this enough. Adopting hybrid models adds significant new responsibilities. Pastors and staff are now juggling traditional duties, plus managing online platforms, creating digital content, engaging online communities, often trying to minister effectively to two distinct audiences simultaneously. It can easily lead to burnout.
Stretching resources very thin.
Extremely thin sometimes. Third, there's the challenge of technological investment and skill gaps. Traditional organizations might struggle with the initial and ongoing cost of equipment, software, and reliable internet. Plus, there's the need for continuous digital literacy training for leaders, staff, and volunteers. Not everyone is tech savvy, and that gap needs to be addressed.
A steep learning curve for some.
It can be. Fourth, misinformation and doctrinal fragmentation. The internet's speed in spreading content, sometimes inaccurate or misleading religious teachings, poses a risk to doctrinal integrity. Leaders need to be even more proactive in providing clear, sound guidance. Fifth, maintaining focus versus consumerism. That attention economy and the consumeristic culture of worship fostered by endless online options can lead individuals to shop around, potentially undermining deep commitment to their local traditional ministry. Loyalty can become more fluid.
People might hop from stream to stream.
Exactly. And finally, number six, online disunity. Paradoxically, the increased visibility online can sometimes amplify minor disagreements or differing perspectives within a congregation. What might have been a quiet grumble before can become a public comment thread, potentially challenging internal cohesion and unity.
So putting it all together, what does this mean for the future of these traditional faith-based communities? It sounds complex, but the memoir seems to suggest there's a path forward despite these challenges.
It does. It doesn't paint a picture of doom and gloom. The memoir concludes this section by emphasizing that while embracing a hybrid model is definitely complex, it's not insurmountable. The key lies in having an intentional strategy. It requires consistent investment in digital literacy for leaders and the congregation. And it needs a clear focus on using the digital as that bridge to deeper in-person engagement. With that kind of careful, strategic approach, the memoir suggests that the benefits, the expanded reach, the enhanced ministry opportunities often can outweigh the drawbacks. This thoughtful integration positions traditional organizations not just to survive, but actually to remain vibrant and relevant, continuing their mission effectively in the digital age. Six, the financial shift. Donations and tithing in hybrid versus traditional church organizations and faith-based organizations.
Let's talk money. Chaplain David has another striking quote here. Giving in the digital age isn't about losing the plate, but expanding the table. Faith's generosity knows no bandwidth limits. That's a really positive way to frame the financial shift, isn't it? Let's dive into how giving has been totally transformed.
It truly is a powerful image, and the memoir makes it clear. The way people give has undergone this profound change, and it's having a direct, massive impact on ministry finances. It reveals what it called a clear hybrid advantage in giving. Recent data, pulled together in the memoir, shows that hybrid faith-based communities, those offering both online and in-person options, often capture more total donations and tithes than traditional-only organizations.
More money overall. Why is that?
Largely, it boils down to the sheer convenience and flexibility of digital options. People can give anytime, anywhere, with just a few clicks. This is strongly underscored by the rise of digital transactions. The memoir cites DonorBox data showing that nearly 50%, almost half, of all ministry giving transactions are now made online or by credit debit card.
Half is huge, so it's not just more transactions happening digitally, but maybe higher amounts too.
Exactly. That's another key point Mr. Everett makes in the memoir. It points towards higher and more consistent giving as a direct result of offering multiple options. Ministries that embrace both in-person and digital giving tend to see not only more frequent giving, but often higher average gift amounts. Especially as recurring online donations, you know, setting up an automatic monthly gift become increasingly popular and incredibly easy for people to manage, it smooths out the giving patterns.
Takes the forgetting the checkbook factor out of it.
Precisely. And this also leads to an expanded donor base. Hybrid models aren't limited to their local geographic area for support. They can receive donations from former members who have moved away, family members in other states, even people around the world who connect with their online ministry. It significantly expands their potential support network.
That's a game changer for some ministries.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the memoir draws a stark contrast here. It highlights that traditional ministries relying solely on in-person giving, like literally just passing the collection plate on Sunday morning, well, they often saw significant decreases in giving, especially if attendance dropped for any reason or members were absent due to travel, illness.
The pandemic must have hit them hard.
Incredibly hard. The memoir notes many traditional organizations experienced sharp declines during the pandemic shutdowns. Meanwhile, ministries that already had strong, established online giving systems in place,
right,
many of them actually maintained or even increased their income during that same period. The difference was dramatic.
So when you look at the bottom line, the financial advantage of the hybrid model seems pretty undeniable.
It really does, based on the trends presented in the memoir. Its summary on this point emphasizes that hybrid faith-based communities, by embracing both digital and in-person giving methods, generally capture more donations and tithes overall. The sheer convenience, the broader reach, the consistency offered by online giving platforms have become a significant tangible advantage for hybrid ministries. It helps them sustain their work and often grow their financial support in ways traditional models struggle to match. The memoir is clear. The future of ministry giving is undeniably integrated with digital platforms, and the ministries that adapt and innovate in this crucial area are the ones being financially rewarded. 7. Who controls a hybrid church, organizations, and faith-based organizations? Unpacking governance.
This shift towards hybrid models, especially independent ones, raises a really important question about structure. Who actually controls a hybrid faith-based community? Does the governance structure depend on how it started, its roots?
Yes, that's exactly right. The memoir explains that the control and governance structure of a hybrid ministry largely depends on its origins, where it came from. If it's what the memoir calls an established ministry, meaning the hybrid model is essentially an extension or an added layer onto an existing traditional faith-based community.
Like a long-standing church adding a live stream and online giving.
Precisely. In that case, the existing governance structure typically just absorbs oversight of the hybrid aspects. So the pastor, the board of elders, the deacons, the parish council, whatever established leadership body oversees the traditional entity, they also oversee the online ministry components. They're the ones setting the vision, managing the finances, including those online donations, and ensuring the online ministry aligns with the organization's overall mission, values, and doctrine. It's integrated into the existing structure.
Okay, that makes sense for established groups. But what about those ministries that start out as hybrid from day one or are completely independent?
Right, that's the other scenario. Independent hybrid ministries. These are ministries established without being directly affiliated with a pre-existing traditional faith-based community. They might be online first or designed as hybrid from the get-go. And for these, the control structure can vary quite widely. The memoir notes, as you mentioned earlier, there are approximately 44,000 independent or non-denominational ministries in the United States alone.
That number is still staggering, 44,000.
It is. It comes from sources like the 2020 U.S. Religion Census and research by the Hartford Institute for Religion Research, cited in the memoir. It really indicates a profound shift in the religious landscape, a move away from traditional denominational structures for many. So how are these independents governed? It varies. They might be led by a founding pastor and a core leadership team. Or they might have a board of directors, much like a secular nonprofit organization. Some might even have a more democratic structure, with an elected body making decisions. There's a lot more diversity in the governance models you see among these independent hybrid ministries compared to the more established denominational ones. It really highlights the innovation and sometimes the lack of traditional oversight in this growing sector.
Oh, yeah.
8, the digital harvest, reaping souls in the online fields.
Now, Chaplain David has another really strong statement in the memoir. He declares, "The digital tide waits for no institution. Embrace it, or watch your message recede with the analog shore." That's quite a warning, isn't it? And the memoir, you're saying, really backs this up with some pretty overwhelming evidence about the necessity of digital engagement.
It's a truth that, frankly, leaders can't afford to ignore anymore. The memoir stresses this point repeatedly. For faith-based communities today, having a robust digital engagement strategy is no longer just a nice-to-have, an optional extra. It is presented as absolutely critical for basic survival and certainly for any kind of growth in the modern world. Why? Because today, ministry members and indeed many people searching for faith or connection increasingly gain their knowledge, build connections, and even discover their faith community primarily through digital platforms.
It's the new front door in many ways.
It absolutely is. And this represents such a fundamental shift in how people operate that pastors and leaders simply must fully embrace it. The memoir argues that digital progression, this tide, will continue moving forward, whether or not individual ministries or leaders choose to fully support it. You either ride the wave or get left behind.
So what is this overwhelming evidence that Chaplain David refers to? What does the memoir present?
It lays out some really compelling data points. Consider this. In 2024, more than 80%, 8 out of 10 ministries, view their website as their primary tool for attracting new members.
80%! That's huge! Not word of mouth, not community events, but the website.
The website is number one for attracting newcomers, according to that data point in the memoir. Furthermore, over a third, 33% of people who end up joining a ministry initially discover it through digital means, like the website or social media. So what does this tell you? It highlights that having an outdated, clunky, or just poorly designed website isn't just a minor inconvenience anymore. It's a significant barrier. It makes it harder for ministries to attract new people and potentially even harder to retain existing members who expect a decent online presence.
So a bad website actively hurts ministry growth.
That's the implication. But on the flip side, the memoir shows that faith-based communities with strong digital platforms are seeing tangible growth. Remember that 32% increase in average online service views in 2024. That's not just passive watching. The memoir links strong digital presence to overall ministry growth. Growing ministries tend to have higher levels of online engagement, and importantly, digital presence is increasingly seen as complementary to in-person worship, not just a temporary replacement like during the pandemic. It's part of the whole package now.
And the reverse is also true, right? The memoir suggests those not adapting are falling behind.
That's precisely right, is the other side of the coin. The memoir notes that ministries that haven't adapted, that don't have a solid digital engagement strategy, are statistically more likely to be experiencing decline in attendance and engagement. It cites, for example, the Unstuck Church report from Q3 2024, which found that churches with weak or non-existent digital strategies were more likely to be losing members, while those with robust online offerings, good website, active social media, quality streaming, were the ones growing or at least maintaining attendance levels.
The data seems pretty clear.
It is. And consider this really sobering statistic presented in the memoir. Every single year, an estimated 2.7 million ministry members in the U.S. fall into inactivity. They just drift away.
2.7 million annually. That's staggering.
It's a huge number. Now, obviously, this isn't solely due to digital issues. There are many complex reasons people leave a faith community. But research consistently shows that key factors include a lack of engagement, feeling disconnected, and a perception that the ministry is irrelevant to their lives. And in today's digital age, the memoir argues, these feelings are very often directly tied to a ministry's inability or unwillingness to connect effectively online, to meet people where they are digitally.
That makes sense. If the ministry feels out of touch digitally, it might feel out of touch generally.
That's the connection being made. Chaplain David affirms this whole reality powerfully when he states, the digital age isn't just a challenge to ministry. It's an invitation to expand our reach, deepen our impact, and rediscover the ancient call in a modern voice. So pulling all this data and insight together, the memoir unequivocally shows that digital engagement isn't some optional add-on anymore. It's a foundational element for any ministry wanting to be effective today. Leaders who resist this digital reality risk isolating their communities and potentially seeing decline. But those who embrace it, they're finding exciting new avenues for connection, for discipleship, and for real, measurable growth. Oh, Sandys, in-person versus online, the heart of true community.
Okay, but let's bring it back to that core tension. Jacqueline Davin offers another perspective. Connection beyond the screen builds true community. Presence fosters the deeper blessing. This touches on something really fundamental, doesn't it? The very nature of what it means to be community, to be together in a meaningful way.
It absolutely does. It goes right to the heart of the debate. The memoir examines what it calls the healthier and truer claim. It discusses how pastors, leaders, and even congregants themselves are often quite split on whether online attendance really counts as genuine ministry participation in the same way as being physically present.
Yeah, that's a hot topic.
It really is. However, the memoir makes it clear that the available data tends to support the unique value of in-person attendance. Study after study cited in the memoir consistently shows that in-person religious attendance correlates strongly with improved mental and physical health outcomes for participants, whereas virtual attendance, the data suggests it does not show the same correlation. In fact, the memoir even states that some studies link primarily online engagement with increased depressive symptoms and loneliness.
Wow, so not only does it lack the benefit, it might even have a negative association in some cases.
That's what some of the cited research suggests. It indicates that online platforms, for all their convenience, may not fully replicate that crucial social capital. The supportive networks, the community ties, the shared physical experiences that seem to confer these tangible health benefits. There's something lost in translation, perhaps.
So being physically present isn't just about, you know, fulfilling an obligation or showing up. It has measurable positive effects.
Exactly. The memoir goes on to detail these numerous tangible benefits of physical presence based on a wide range of sociological and health studies. In terms of physical health, regular in-person attendance is linked to things like increased longevity, reduced overall mortality rates, and even better survival rates for certain diseases.
That's remarkable.
It is. For mental health, the benefits are also striking. Less depression, lower suicide rates, decreased stress levels, increased self-esteem, and a greater sense of hope and purpose in life. On a social and relational level, studies link it to reduced divorce risk, having more close friends, stronger social support networks, and improved marriage relationships among attendees.
Building stronger bonds.
Yes. And finally, in terms of behavioral and community impact, in-person attendance is associated with lower rates of smoking, alcohol abuse, and drug abuse. Also, increased generosity and charitable giving, decreased domestic violence, reduced crime rates in the surrounding community, and even higher educational aspirations among students from attending families.
That's a wide range of positive impacts. Where do they come from?
The memoir suggests these benefits likely stem from a combination of factors fostered by physical gathering. Expanded social support networks, healthier lifestyle behaviors, often encouraged by religious teachings, and perhaps most importantly, a greater sense of meaning and purpose derived from shared faith and community involvement. Plus, there are those unique, mood-lifting experiences that can happen during corporate worship or fellowship that are hard to replicate alone online.
And this is where the memoir loops back to that key scripture again, isn't it? To reinforce the importance of gathering.
It does, referencing Hebrews chapter 10, verse 25 once more. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. It really underscores the consistent biblical emphasis on communal physical gathering. The memoir then explores congregant perspectives on active participation and connection, revealing some really interesting insights from surveys and studies. For instance, even among those who participate in hybrid worship, a significant majority, 76%, say they prefer attending in person when they can.
So even the people using online options often still value being there.
That's what the data suggests. Then there's the issue of passive online engagement we discussed earlier. Only about a quarter, 25% of virtual viewers actually feel like active participants during an online service. And remember those other stats. A large majority, 61%, don't typically engage in physical actions like praying aloud or singing along at home. And a striking 64% admit to multitasking while watching.
Doing other things while the service is on.
Right. In contrast, people attending in person report significantly higher feelings of connection with God and with their fellow worshipers compared to those attending virtually. there seems to be a qualitative difference in the connection experienced. And finally, the memoir briefly touches again on online disunity. It notes that the increased visibility of differing opinions or minor irritations online can sometimes amplify conflict within congregations, potentially challenging internal cohesion. It references Romans chapter 16, verse 17, which warns, "Now I beseech you, brethren, mark them which cause divisions and offenses contrary to the doctrine which ye have learned, and avoid them." A call to guard unity.
It's such a complex picture. But then you have Chaplain David's observation, which reflects the reality for so many people. Church, organizations, and faith-based organizations isn't just Sundays anymore. It's the podcast in my car, the Bible app on my phone, and the live stream when I travel. This is how I stay fed, whether my local church, organizations, and faith-based organizations fully embraces it or not. That speaks volumes about personal initiative and how people are actually living out their faith journey today, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. It captures that blend, that personal integration of different sources of spiritual nourishment that defines the experience for many believers in the digital age. They're crafting their own spiritual diet, in a way. Ex-consuming faith, engaging with digital religious content.
And that leads perfectly into this idea from David Averitt. Micro-discipleship is shaping macro-faith. Let's meet seekers where they are, not just where we've always been. That feels like a really profound shift in thinking about how people grow spiritually.
It's a huge shift in perspective, yes. The memoir details the rise of Bible apps, podcasts, and religion-focused videos as primary tools for this. It cites data showing many U.S. adults are regularly turning to these digital channels, specifically for religious content. Around 30% search online for religious information. 21% use scripture apps daily or weekly, 15% listen to religion or spirituality podcasts, and 20% watch faith-focused videos online.
Those are significant percentages using digital tools for faith.
They really are. And think back to YouVersion's Bible app, 875 million installations globally. The memoir points out the top searches within apps like that are often prayer and peace, showing people are actively using these tools to seek solace and connection. This whole trend facilitates what the memoir terms micro-discipleship.
Right, that term again. Break it down for us.
It's the idea that spiritual growth isn't just happening in hour-long sermons or weekly Bible studies anymore. People are consuming spiritual nourishment in these shorter, more frequent, often highly personalized formats throughout their week. A 5-minute devotional on an app, a 20-minute podcast episode during a commute, a short teaching clip shared on social media. It's about ongoing, integrated spiritual formation in bite-sized pieces. And this offers ministries tremendous opportunities to engage people beyond the traditional Sunday morning slot.
And social media is obviously a massive engine driving this, right?
Right, undeniably. The memoir highlights social media's influence on religious engagement and community. It notes how platforms like Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and others are facilitating virtual group chats, online Bible studies, shared prayer requests, live Q&As with leaders. In many ways, social media is effectively extending the very definition of what a faith-based community can look like and how it functions. It creates new spaces for connection.
But it's not all positive, is it? The memoir points out challenges too.
Definitely not all positive. The memoir outlines several significant challenges associated with faith on social media. We've touched on the easy spread of misinformation and questionable theology. There's also the potential erosion of traditional religious authority, as charismatic online figures gain influence, sometimes irrespective of formal training or accountability. And the increased online visibility of differing views, as we mentioned, can sometimes fuel disunity or conflict.
And the memoir introduces another interesting concept here, the digital panopticon.
Yes, the digital panopticon effect. It's the idea that in a highly visible, often scrutinizing environment of social media, minor theological nuances, personal opinions, or even off-the-cuff remarks by leaders or members can be taken out of context, amplified, and used to create division or controversy. Everyone feels like they're constantly being watched and judged.
That sounds stressful.
It can be, but which means ministries need to be incredibly mindful and proactive in managing their online presence to foster health and maintain internal cohesion. The memoir references James chapter 3, verse 16 here. "For where envying and strife is, there is confusion and every evil work." It serves as a reminder of the potential pitfalls of unchecked online discourse within a faith community. It's a landscape with both immense potential for connection and significant risks of division. Challenges and opportunities for pastors in the digital age.
So let's focus on the leaders navigating this complex terrain. Chaplain David offers this compelling vision. The digital age demands an augmented pastor equipped with ancient truths and modern tools. That really frames the challenge and the opportunity, doesn't it?
It's a fantastic framing. An augmented pastor. The memoir uses this idea to explore the specific challenges and opportunities pastors face today. First, it dives into the significant ethical considerations. These aren't trivial. Number one is data privacy. As ministries collect more digital data, member info, giving records, online interactions, they have a profound ethical responsibility to protect it. Robust cybersecurity isn't just a tech issue. It's about maintaining trust.
Absolutely critical.
Second is combating misinformation. Pastors are.
We've reached the end of part one. Get ready, because part two is hot off the presses and ready for your ears right now.
Thanks for joining us on The Growth Journey. If you're ready to keep growing in faith, leadership, and life, be sure to follow the show and share it with someone on their own path. For more resources to connect with David Averett, visit cajailoutreach.org. Until next time, keep pursuing real life, real growth, and divinely inspired results.